Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today sheds new light on some of the earliest divides between America's founding fathers. The men who won the Revolution, then developed and ratified the Constitution, were riven by bitter divides over the future course of the United States and how our government would be designed and work. While we know the divide between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson helped create political parties, which have shaped America to this day, my guest, Thomas Fleming, says that divide actually began with George Washington and Jefferson, and their differing views about the importance of the presidency has been at the center of our divide in politics to this day. He writes about this conflict in his very interesting yet opinionated history, The Great Divide, the conflict between Washington and Jefferson that defined a nation. Thomas Fleming is a noted historian and historical novelist who's written over 40 books involving America's history. His works include consulting and writing for the PBS series The Irish in America, Liberty, the American Revolution, as well as the revisionist histories including 1776, Year of Illusions, Washington's Secret War, and The Perils of Peace. His new book, The Great Divide, is published by DeCapo. Thomas Fleming, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
When casual students think of the divide in the political philosophies and thinkings of the founders, I think most look to the divide between presidents two and three, John Adams, the New Englander, and Thomas Jefferson, the Virginian, and the beginnings of political parties. But your book says that this conflict goes further back to the origins of the Constitution, and it's really a conflict between the visions of George Washington and Jefferson. Why does the Great Divide begin with these two Virginians?
It's fascinating because it's more than a geographical divide. It's a philosophic divide. Washington was the ultimate, as somebody once called him, the ultimate pragmatist. I think the word ultimate is a little too harsh, but he was a very realistic man. His whole view of human nature was we must take men as they are, not as we wish them to be. However, Washington did have one quality, along with his pragmatism, that has caused one of his biographers to call him a visionary realist. He really truly believed in the essential idea of America, a free country with freedom permeating all its levels. He was totally in favor of that. He even disapproved of slavery. Whereas Thomas Jefferson was a very different type of guy. He was basically an ideologue, someone whose ideas churned in his mind and he didn't let the influences of the real world change them very much. And he thought that we didn't need a lot of government. We didn't need hardly any. But the crucial thing is, in every argument about ideas, there's always a personal element. And in this case, the personal element consists of the fact that Jefferson had nothing to do with writing the Constitution. He was in France during the whole time that James Madison and George Washington first began conversing on the porch at Mount Vernon about the need for a better federal government, and then that led to a federal constitution. And then Washington, in a very interesting touch, I always look for this when I write a history book, are the little things, and Washington started signing his letters to Madison affectionately. Hmm. He did that for very few people. That wasn't his style, but it was a sign of how much he appreciated Madison's qualities. But he in turn, was able to talk to Madison very frankly and get him to listen. And at this Constitutional Convention, Washington said, we must have a strong federal government, and the essence of that strong federal government, the essence of any organization, a large organization, is leadership. There has to be, at the top, a president whose powers are virtually co-equal to Congress.
Now, the popular history was that Washington was the unifying force as president of the convention.
He was, no doubt about it.
He was that, but what your book says was he might have been the unifying force, but he was moving behind the scenes quite importantly. He and Madison had been in league, and they were working hand in glove through the Constitutional Convention to get some version of what they had passed.
Right. The essence of what they wanted, particularly what Washington wanted anyway, was this strong presidency. And as we stop and think just a moment, he spent 8 years as head of the Continental Army dealing with the Continental Congress. There was the president of the Continental Congress. There was a man who had the title, but he had so little power that he couldn't even answer a letter if it was sent to him. He had to give it to one of the congressmen who would then form a committee. It was laughably unexecutive, you might say. And Washington saw this led to all kinds of drift and confusion. So he was so strong on this point. It's so fascinating to me how this worked out. So Jefferson gets the Constitution. He's still in France as ambassador, and he reads it, and he's shocked that this changed the government so drastically. He thought all they had to do was add three or four clauses to the old Constitution, which was called the Articles of Confederation. He couldn't have been more wrong. And the thing that he disliked the most in the new Constitution was the presidency. He called it a bad edition of a Polish king. I'm glad you're laughing, because I laugh when I read it. I really did. You know, because I grew up, my father was a politician in Jersey City, New Jersey, and ethnic jokes were constantly with us, you know.
Yeah.
This sounded like, when I first read it, like an ethnic joke. You know? But what Jefferson really meant was, since he spent a lot of time in Europe by this time, was the King of Poland was elected by the people. Oh, he was a nobleman, of course.
Right.
And then he served for life, and that was the point with Jefferson. He disliked the presidency intensely because he thought it was going to lead to a dictatorship or a king.
Now, your earlier comment said, you know, one of the things that Jefferson was upset about was he didn't have any hand in writing this because he was in France. Now, that sounds like peak to me, but and then you relate a story about the Declaration of Independence I'd never heard before, was that, you know, he wrote the draft. Adams and Franklin made a few edits, but when it went to the floor of the Continental Congress, they made wholesale changes. And
they changed about 50% of the document. They really did,
Yeah, and he would privately circulate his own draft to his friends saying, look, isn't my version better?
Now, that is very good. That is, I'm glad you brought this up, because I think that's a very typical Jeffersonian approach to things. He was very proud of his opinions, and particularly of something that was his writing, that in which he'd written some of his opinions. However, I think we have to give Jefferson credit for those opening paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence. They're the things that echo down the ages and made, I'm working on a book now, or hoping to work on it anyway, about the whole revolution, and I call it a revolution that changed the world, which it really did, you know. And and the key reason why I say that is after we won our victory in 1783, there were about, in the next 100 to 150 years, there was about 200 more declarations of independence all over the world that echoed in some ways Jefferson's. It showed the power of those early ideas that he had. They were common ideas. He said it. He admitted that. They were ideas that were being talked about in all the states at that time. But he did put them into some striking phrases.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you consider Jefferson to be an ideologue. Another version of an ideologue is an idealist.
Yes, and this is you're right. An ideologue is very closely linked to idealism. And a very bright young man who worked with Jefferson as his secretary in Paris said that he saw the human nature through his own experience, his own personality. And he thought, I don't need a very powerful government. I don't need any leadership. I can think my way to freedom and equality and so forth and so forth. And he just didn't think that this was likely to be threatened by the rest of the people around him in the country. But the fact of the matter was, it was, you know. And so this young man called it an amiable error. But it was an error. And Jefferson didn't like the whole president leadership style.
And as your book makes clear, I mean, your book is a little opinionated towards Jefferson, I think. You look at his actions somewhat from a jaundiced view at times, and you relate some interesting stories, because even as early as the ratification of the Constitution, Jefferson is actively trying to undermine the adoption of the Constitution, even though there was a promise of a Bill of Rights, which we always think that was Jefferson's insistence, and it was, But even
but
with
a lot of other people, yeah, let me just say that, there's a lot of people. George Mason of Virginia was one of Washington's nearby neighbors. He too screamed and demanded a Bill of Rights and so forth and so forth. And but Madison didn't think that one was needed, but he went along with Jefferson and Mason and people like that because he thought that this would eliminate some opposition to the Constitution. There was getting the Constitution ratified was quite a struggle and a close call in several states.
But the rancor of the divide, you let us know in the very opening sentences when a quote by Martha Washington. Tell us that quote by Martha Washington.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, too. Martha Washington, after George died, a congressman from New Hampshire visited her. He was a great admirer of Washington and so forth. And fortunately, he kept a diary. And so in this diary, I found that he asked Martha, he was expressing his sympathy and so forth and so forth. It's about a year after George had died, and Martha sighed and said, "Oh, Mr. Congressman, you know the two worst days of my life? One was the day that George died, and two was the day that President Jefferson came to pay his condolences."
Wow.
And Martha, incidentally, this is all, I always love this little incident. Martha burned all the letters that she exchanged with George.
Mm-hmm.
Only, I think, four survived, mostly by accident. And that remark suggests that they were very close and that he talked politics to her a good deal.
And certainly by that particular time, the end of Washington's life, this break had occurred between Jefferson and Washington. You write that Jefferson was undermining the presidency as serving as Secretary of State. He was literally opposed to this idea of a president with what we would come to know as executive powers.
Exactly, yeah. And I recently, this is not in the book, but I think you'll appreciate it. I recently came across a letter that Jefferson wrote in 1825. That was the last full year of his life. He died in 1826. And he was writing to a young politician who had recently returned to America after being abroad in the American government. And he got into what are the big issues that we're still struggling with here in this country. And he immediately went to the conflict between the executive and the legislature. And he said, "Our concern is to keep the legislature pure of executive influence." What a revelation that is, I thought. It confirmed everything that I'd been writing in the book about Jefferson, that for him, executive power had a certain impurity in it. I think because he saw that it could lead to dictatorships, blah, blah, blah.
He was a true Republican in the small sense of the R. I mean,
absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, my guest today is Thomas Fleming, a historian and historical novelist. He's the author of numerous books. His latest is titled The Great Divide, The Conflict Between Washington and Jefferson That Defined a Nation, published by DeCapo. And we'll talk a little bit later about how this divide has been a part of our politics ever since. But I want to talk about something. Madison plays a huge role, first as a confidant to George Washington as they're drafting the Constitutional Convention. At other times, he'd been very close with Jefferson.
Yeah.
And throughout Madison's life, he moves from orbit to orbit, this Washington to Jefferson orbit. In fact, I sort of jokingly said, the great divide is over the political beliefs and soul of James Madison, in a way.
There is, as I said, there is some truth to it. There really is. But he was deeply, deeply influenced by Jefferson's personality. Jefferson was the man who first recognized, when he was governor of Virginia, someone got Madison a job as a governor's counselor. Under the Virginia Constitution, the governor had about five or six advisors who were supposedly he was supposed to listen to, and so forth. And very quickly, Jefferson recognized that Madison was so far superior to the rest of them that he practically did nothing but listen to him in his 2 years as governor. And that, I think, had a very great influence on Madison's fondness for Jefferson, because Madison was a very unprepossessing character. He was short, thin. He had a weak voice. Just, you could almost say he was the image of an anti-politician. You know, he didn't impress people at first glance, but after you talk to him for a while, whoa! Suddenly you realize what a brain, what a mind. You know.
And so what moved Madison, who was the architect of the Constitution, helped put the Bill of Rights in, helped devised the rhetoric which got the states to ratify the Constitution.
Yes.
How does he move into Jefferson's camp? What moved him into Jefferson's camp, into this idea of stronger republic, weaker presidency?
Yes, that really wasn't part of it. Madison was not afraid of a strong presidency at all. I think it was this fondness for Jefferson, and then Jefferson's emphatic disagreements with Washington, which forced Madison to make choices. I think that had a lot to do with it. But also Madison was very influenced. He was a politician, you know, and it was Virginia politics that had a lot to do with his tilt toward Jefferson, because Virginia was the biggest state in those days, and it's hard for us to realize how important that meant. I mean, they had a big edge in population over the rest of the country, and they really assumed that they were running the country. Everybody in Massachusetts, of course, the politicians up there, they didn't agree with that, to put it mildly, and that was part of the conflict which eventually led to the Civil War. But I do think that the Virginia politics had a lot to do with it. Patrick Henry had taken a violent hatred to Madison, and he and Madison dueled over ratifying the Constitution, and Madison won. And that really made Henry even more infuriated with him. So when Madison, he was a congressman, he had to run for election, and he needed support. And so he could see that Washington wasn't thinking like a Virginian anymore. That's the amazing thing about Washington. He imbibed a national view almost, not instinctively, but by experience, you know, by running that Continental Army, which was composed of men from every state, and he had to live all over the country with the Army. He saw how important it was to have no prejudice against any part of one state against the other and that sort of thing. But this was not easy for Madison to do. And so he tilted toward going along with Jefferson, who was very much inclined to follow Virginia's, to consider Virginia a crucial factor in the whole scheme of things.
You mentioned that Jefferson was away during the Constitutional Convention. In fact, Jefferson really doesn't come back to America from France until the opening, really after the opening shots of the French Revolution in 1789 to become...
Yes, he got back to America in 1790. You know? And so he saw the French Revolution. It was a marvelous opportunity to see how Jefferson thought and acted in a political framework, but with this compound of realism and idealism, you know. And he fell in love with the French Revolution.
Yeah.
He called it my polar star. And it was more important in many ways than America, and at least at times it seemed to be.
But when he comes back to America, all of a sudden we've already sort of adopted some of the conventions we would associate with the president. He was appalled. I mean, it was like to him it was something between the court of London and the continental capitals he came from. It was we'd adopted all sorts of ceremony on the presidency, and he hated that. He hated that. He just thought it was we were setting ourselves up for a king.
He hated anything that even smacked or hinted of anything British. And that goes back again. I'd love to get into the human factor in this sort of thing. Jefferson was ambassador to France, and John Adams was ambassador to England. And Adams invited Jefferson to come over and pay him a visit. And they had a very nice time together, and they toured England and looked at the gardens. Jefferson was such a... He loved to get into the technology of farming and all that. But anyway, in the course of this, Adams invited him to the court of the king, and he introduced him to George III. And by this time, Adams had achieved a rather cordial relationship with King George. But when the king heard the word Thomas Jefferson, he immediately thought of all the insults to himself that were in the Declaration of Independence, and he turned his back on Jefferson and refused even to shake his hand.
Wow.
And a lot of people, including me, think Jefferson never got over this.
Well, my guest today is Thomas Fleming, historian and historical novelist. His new book is The Great Divide, The Conflict Between Washington and Jefferson That Defined a Nation. It's published by DeCapo. And One of the things you write about that I really never thought about in Jefferson's presidency, you also talk about his being governor of Virginia, in which he shows this sort of unwillingness to govern effectively. And you said, right, especially in the presidency, he opens up a lot of, well, this is a question we're still hearing about today, and that's the idea of nullification of a federal law. He talks about this to Kentucky. He says, well, if you don't like the law, just nullify it.
Yeah, this was before he became president. Huh? That was in 1798. That was in relation to two bills that the Congress had passed, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which gave very large power to the executive and the judicial branch to retaliate against someone who attacked them and slandered them or anything like
that. Which, granted, was a bad law.
And it was a terrible law, yes. But the interesting thing about Jefferson is he was a lawyer. My son is a lawyer, incidentally, so I'm not knocking lawyers, but I'm just pointing out the way they think. And when Jefferson got to be president, he was so upset by the Alien and Sedition Acts that he said that a state could vote to secede from the Union rather than honor them. And that was a very bad, bad thing to say. Jefferson never could get it through his head that the Constitution was ratified by the people, not by the states. And he repeatedly talked about states opposing the federal government and so forth, which eventually they did in a very disastrous way in 1860. But he didn't see anything wrong with that. Whereas Madison, even, and a lot of other people who had been there for the Constitution, or creating the Constitution and its ratification, they insisted, they kept pointing out, the Constitution was ratified by the people. The people of each state formed a convention. Not their legislatures had nothing to do with ratifying the Constitution. These people, these popular conventions were put together by vote, and then they voted whether to approve the Constitution or not. So that it's a big difference, particularly from a legal or philosophical point of view. The average person doesn't seem that much of a difference, you know. But it is. It's a very big distinction, because Madison was horrified that Jefferson was trying to bring state legislatures into this conflict about the Alien and Sedition Acts, and that was not what Madison really wanted. He saw right away that this would lead to disaster, and there was a lot of things going on like that that gave you a glimpse of Jefferson's thinking. For another great example of it is he hated the Bank of the United States. Why? This was the first, you might say, Federal Reserve, and it was created by Alexander Hamilton, who was the Secretary of the Treasury. And it was too British as far as Jefferson was concerned. And there's no question it was based to some, it was an imit, it was some to some extent an imitation of the Bank of England. But Jefferson and the Bank of the United States sold shares to investors, and they were going to use the money they made from that to pay off the national debt. Well, Jefferson just didn't buy into any of this. And when he heard that merchants from Richmond were rushing to Philadelphia to get into the stock market, they hadn't opened an office. The bank hadn't opened an office in Richmond. So they were rushing up to Philadelphia to buy stock in the Bank of the United States. And he wrote to Madison, yes, they're on their way to Philadelphia to buy their federal filth.
Well,
he's talking about his own government, you know?
Yeah. Now, one of the thesis of this conflict between Washington's vision of a constitutional democracy and Jefferson's vision of what the United States should be has informed our politics ever since. You've made several allusions to the Civil War, but how is this continuing to the 20th century and the 21st century, for that matter?
We've had these revolving conflicts between the executive and the legislature that have swelled up at various times. After the Civil War, when Lincoln was dead and assassinated and so forth, Congress they were infuriated by Lincoln. Washington was a strong president, Lincoln was, he took Washington to way beyond what anybody thought could be done in order to win the Civil War. And the legislature was infuriated by it, and they announced from when Andrew Johnson, the vice president, took over, and he was not the brightest bulb in the world, the Congress announced that henceforth the Congress was in command of the country, and the president was their servant. And for 40 years, 40 to 50 years, we had weak presidents, very weak presidents, and a very strong legislature.
Perhaps Teddy Roosevelt.
In the country.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt was probably the person who broke that mold.
Exactly. He broke the mold. And here's the interesting thing that I think is worth remembering. Somebody asked him, where did you get this idea for the strong presidency? And Roosevelt said, I'm basing my actions on the Lincoln-Jackson. He's speaking of Andrew Jackson tradition. He didn't even mention George Washington. Mm. Why? This is, I think, the most surprising part of the last part of my book, and that is Jefferson did everything in his power to obliterate Washington's presidency. He praised Washington as a great patriot, but he never said one thing in praise of his presidency, and he made his presidency the opposite in every way he could think of. He ended all presidential proclamations, and he didn't have these receptions like Washington, formal receptions. Jefferson was so wildly determined to do this that he used to wander around the White House. Anybody could visit the White House that wanted to. But we ought to remember that when he did this, when he said this, he was living in Washington, D.C., which I call, with good reason, the Federal Village.
Yes.
The population was about 4,000 or 5,000 people. If he tried to do this in Philadelphia or New York, he would have been absolutely buried in visitors and so forth. But at any rate, one of these random visitors wandered into the house, and he met this guy wearing the sloppiest clothes he ever saw in his life, and he thought he was some sort of a carpenter or something. And he said, could you tell me where President Jefferson is? I'd like to speak to him.
Well,
this was the ultimate, you might say, reductio ad absurdum of pushing against the formal presidency, you know?
Oh, the name of the book is The Great Divide. Thomas Fleming, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Historian and historical novelist Thomas Fleming speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Great Divide, The Conflict Between Washington and Jefferson That Defined a Nation. It's published by DeCapo. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, just go to studiotulsa.org to catch up with some of our more recent episodes. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.